Looks as though we're quits at 16 Solons 5. I suppose it beats driving a shit wagon, doesn't it?
Or running a pawn shop, yes, said Locke.
Very amusing,
cried the old man as he counted out 16 tarnished silver coins and 5 smaller copper discs.
I give you the legendary lost treasure of Camor. Grab your things and fuck off until next week, assuming the Grey King doesn't get you first.
5. The rain had faded back to a drizzle when they emerged from Haza's shop, giggling to themselves. Chains used to claim that there's no freedom quite like the freedom of being constantly underestimated, said Locke.
Gods, yes.
Carlo rolled his eyes and stuck out his tongue.
If we were any freer, we'd float away into the sky and fly like the birds.
From the northern edge of the wooden waste, a long, high wooden bridge, wide enough for 2 people, ran straight out to the Kappa's waterbound fortress. There were 4 men on guard at the shore, standing around in the open with weapons clearly visible under their lightweight oil cloaks. Locke surmised there would be at least as many concealed nearby within easy crossbow shot. He made the month's proper hand signs as he approached with his gang behind him. Everyone here knew each other, but the formalities were non-negotiable, especially at a time like this.
Hello, Lamora.
The oldest man in the guard detail, a wiry old fellow with faded shark tattoos running up his neck and his cheeks all the way to his temples, reached out. They grasped left forearms.
Heard about Tesso?
Yeah, hello yourself, Burnell. One of the grey faces told us on the way down.
So it's true? Nailed up, balls, the whole bit? Balls, the whole bit. You can imagine how the boss feels about it. Speaking of which, Nazca left orders. Just this morning. Next time you came by, she wanted to see you. Said not to let you pay your taxes until she'd had a word. You are here for taxes, right?
Locke shook a little grey purse. Jean's 20 solons plus Harza's 16 and change.
Here to do our civic duty, indeed.
Good. Not passing many folks for any other reason. Look, I know you've got the distance and Nazca's a friend and all, but maybe you want to take it real easy today, right? Lots of peasant around, obvious and not so obvious, tight as it's ever been. Kappa's making inquiries with some of the full crowns right now, as regards their whereabouts last night.
Inquiries?
In the grand old fashion. So mind your manners and don't make any sudden moves, right?
Savvy, said Locke. Thanks for the warning.
No trouble. Crossbow bolts cost money. Shame to waste them on the likes of you.
Burnell waved them through, and they strolled down the wooden walkway, which was about 100 yards long. It led to the stern of the wide, motionless vessel, where the timbers of the outer hull had been cut away and replaced with a pair of iron-reinforced witchwood doors. Another pair of guards stood here, one male and one female, the dark circles under their eyes plainly evident. The woman knocked 4 times at their approach, and the doors swung inward just a few seconds later. Stifling a yawn, the female guard leaned back against the outer wall and pulled the hood of her oil cloak up over her head. The dark clouds were sweeping in from the north, and the heat of the sun was starting to fade. The reception hall of the floating grave was nearly 4 times Locke's height, as the cramped horizontal decks of the old galleon had been torn out long ago, save for the upper castle and waste decks, which now served as roofs. The floor and walls were coffee-coloured hardwood. The bulkheads were hung with black and red tapestries on which shark's teeth border patterns were embroidered in gold and silver thread. A 6 bravos stood facing the gentleman bastards, crossbows levelled. These men and women wore leather bracers and leather doublets over silk tunics reinforced with light metal bands. Their necks were girded with stiff leather collars. A more genteel foyer would have been decorated with glow lamps and flower arrangements. The walls of this one held wicker baskets of crossbow quarrels and racks of spare blades.
"Ease up," said a young woman standing behind the gaggle of guards. "I know they're suspicious as hell, but I don't see a Grey King among 'em."
She wore men's breeches and a loose black silk blouse with billowing sleeves under a ribbed leather dueling harness that looked to have seen more use than storage. Her iron-shod boots, a taste she had never lost, clicked against the floor as she stepped between the sentries. Her welcoming smile didn't quite reach all the way to her eyes, which darted nervously behind the lenses of her plain, black-rimmed optics.
"My apologies for the reception, loves," said Nazca Barsavi, addressing all the bastards but placing a hand on Locke's left shoulder. She was a full 2 inches taller than he was. "And I know it's cramped in here, but I need the four of you to wait around. Garistas only. Papa's in a mood."
There was a muffled scream from behind the doors that led to the inner chambers of the floating grave, followed by the faint murmur of raised voices, shouts, cursing, another scream. Nazca rubbed her temples, pushed back a few stray curls of her black hair, and sighed.
"He's making a vigorous case for full disclosure from some of the full crowns. He's got sage kindness in there with him."
13 gods, said Carlo. "We're happy to wait."
"Indeed."
Galdo reached into his coat and pulled out a slightly soggy deck of playing cards.
"We can certainly keep ourselves entertained out here, indefinitely if need be."
At the sight of a Sansa brother offering cards, every guard in the room took a step back. Some of them visibly struggled with the idea of raising their crossbows again.
"Oh, not you bastards, too," said Galdo. "Look, those stories are all bullshit. Everyone else at that table was just having a very unlucky night."
Past the wide, heavy doors was a short passage, unguarded and empty. Nazca slid the foyer doors closed behind herself and Locke, then turned to him. She reached and slicked back his wet hair. The corners of her mouth were turned down.
"Hello, Pezon. I see you haven't been eating."
"I eat regular meals."
"You should try eating for quantity as well as consistency. I believe I once mentioned that you looked like a skeleton."
"And I believe I'd never before seen a 7-year-old girl pushy drunk in public."
"Well, perhaps I was pushy drunk then, but today I'm just pushy.
Papa's in a bad way, Locke.
I wanted to see you before you saw him. He has some things he wishes to discuss with you. I want you to know that whatever he asks, I don't want you to, for my sake, well, please just agree. Please him. Do you understand?"
"No Garista who loves life has ever tried to do otherwise. You think I'm inclined to walk in on a day like today and deliberately twist his breeches? If your father says bark like a dog, I say, what breed, Your Honor?"
"I know. Forgive me. But my point is this. He's not himself. He's afraid now, Locke. Absolutely, genuinely afraid. He was morose when Mother died, but damn, now he's crying out in his sleep, taking wine and laudanum every day to keep his temper in check. Used to be I was the only one not allowed to leave the grave, but now he wants Anjace and Panchero to stay here, too. 50 guards on duty at all times. The Duke's life is more carefree. Papa and my brothers were up shouting about it all night."
"Well, look, I'm sorry, but I don't think I can help you with that. But just what is it you think he's going to ask me?"
Nazca stared at him, mouth half open as though she were preparing to speak. Then she seemed to think better of it, and her lips compressed back into a frown.
"Damn it, Nazca! I'd jump in the bay to try to blackjack a shark if you wanted, really! But you'd have to tell me how big it was and how hungry it was first. Savvy?"
"Yes. Look, I just... It'll be less awkward if he does it himself. Just remember what I said. Hear him. Please him. and you and I can sort things out later. If we get her later.
What do you mean, if we get her later? Nazca, you're worrying me.
This is it, Locke. This is the bad one. The Grey King is finally getting to Papa.
Tesso had 60 knives, any 10 of which were with him all the time. Tesso was deep into Papa's good graces. There were big plans for him in the near future, but Papa's had things his way for so long, I can't rightly say if he knows what to do about this. So he just wants to fold everything up and hide us here. Siege mentality.
Locke sighed. I can't say that what he's done so far is imprudent, Nazca. He's...
Papa's mad if he thinks he can just keep us all here, locked up in this fortress forever. He used to be at the last mistake half the nights of the week. He used to walk the docks, walk the Mara, walk the Narrows any time he pleased. He used to throw out coppers at the procession of the Shades. The Duke of Camor can lock himself in his privy and rule legitimately. The copper of Camor cannot. He needs to be seen.
And risk assassination by the Grey King?
Look, I've been stuck inside this fucking wooden tub for 2 months, and I tell you, we're no safer here than we would be bathing naked at the dirtiest fountain in the darkest courtyard in the cauldron.
Nazca had folded her arms beneath her breast so tightly that her leather cuirass creaked.
Who is this Grey King? Where is he? Who are his men? We don't have a single idea, and yet this man reaches out and kills our people at leisure, however he sees fit. Something is wrong. He has resources we don't understand.
He's clever and he's lucky. Neither of those things lasts forever, trust me.
Not just clever and lucky, Locke. I agree there are limits to both. So what does he have up his sleeves? What does he know? Or who? If we are not betrayed, then it must be that we are overmatched. And I am reasonably certain that we are not yet betrayed.
Not yet?
Don't play stupid with me, Locke. Business could go on after a fashion with Papa and myself cooped up here. But if he won't let Andres and Panchero out to run the city, the whole regime will go to hell. The Garistas might think it prudent for some of the Barsavis to stay here. They'll think it cowardice for all of us to hide. And they won't just talk behind our backs. They'll actively court another Kappa. Maybe a pack of new Kappas. Or maybe the Grey King.
So naturally your brothers will never let him trap them here.
Depends on how mad and crazy the old man gets. But even if they stay free to roam, that's only the lesser part of the problem solved. We are again overmatched. 3,000 knives at our command, and the ghost still has the twist on us.
What do you suspect? Sorcery?
I suspect everything. They say the Grey King can kill a man with just a touch. They say that blades won't cut him. I suspect the gods themselves, and so my brothers think I'm crazy. When they look at the situation, all they see is a regular war. They think we can just outlast it, lock the old man and the baby sister up, and wait until we know where to hit back. But I don't see that. I see a cat with his paw over a mouse's tail. And if the cat's claws haven't come out yet, it's not because of anything the mouse has done. Don't you get it?
Nazca, I know you're agitated. I'll listen. I'm a stone. You can yell at me all you like.
But what can I do for you? I'm just a thief. I'm your father's littlest thief.
If there's a gang smaller than mine, I'll go play cards in a wolf shark's mouth.
I need you to start helping me calm Papa down, Locke. I need him back to something resembling his normal self, so I can get him to take my point seriously. That's why I'm asking you to go in there and take pains to please him, especially please him. Show him a loyal Garista who does whatever he's told, the moment he's told. When he starts to lay reasonable plans for the future again, I'll know he's coming back to a state of mind I can deal with.
Interesting, said Locke. And, daunting.
Papa used to say someday I'd appreciate having a gracious man to order around. Believe me, Locke, I do. So, here we are.
At the end of the short passage was another set of heavy wooden doors, nearly identical to the ones that led back to the reception hall. These doors, however, were barred and locked with an elaborate Ferrari clockwork device attached to crossbars of polished iron. A dozen keyholes were visible in the lockbox at the center of the doors. Nazca withdrew two keys that hung on a chain around her neck and briefly put her body between Locke and the doors so he couldn't see the apertures she chose. There was a cascading series of clicks and the noise of machinery within the doors. One by one the hidden bolts unshot themselves and the gleaming crossbars slid open until the doors finally cracked open in the middle. Another scream, loud and vivid without the closed door to muffle it, sounded from the room beyond.
"It's worse than it sounds," said Nazca.
"I know what sage does for your father, Nazca."
"Knowing's one thing. Usually sage just does one or two at a time. Papa's got the bastard working wholesale today."
6.
"I've made it clear that I don't enjoy this," said Kappa Barsavi. "So why do you force me to persist?"
The dark-haired young man was secured to a wooden rack. He hung upside down with metal shackles around his legs, with arms tied downward at their maximum extension. The copper's heavy fist slammed into the prisoner's side just beneath his armpit. The sound was like a hammer slapping meat. Droplets of sweat flew, and the prisoner screamed, writhing against his restraints.
"Why do you insult me like this, Federico?"
Another punch to the same spot, with the heavy old man's first two knuckles cruelly extended.
"Why don't you even have the courtesy to give me a convincing lie?"
Kappa Barsavi lashed Federico's throat with the flat of one hand. The prisoner gasped for breath, snorting wetly as blood and spit and sweat ran down into his nose. The heart of the floating grave was something like an opulent ballroom with curving sides. Warm amber light came from glass globes suspended on silver chains. Stairs ran to overhead galleries, and from these galleries to the silk-canopied deck of the old hulk. A small raised platform against the far wall held the broad wooden chair from which Barsavi usually received visitors. The room was tastefully decorated in a restrained and regal fashion, and today it stank of fear and sweat and soiled breeches. The frame that held Federico folded downward from the ceiling. An entire semicircle of the things could be pulled down at need, for Barsavi occasionally did this sort of business in a volume that rewarded the standardization of procedures. 6 were now empty and spattered with blood. Only 2 still held prisoners. The capo looked up as Locke and Nazca entered. He nodded slightly and gestured for them to wait against the wall. Old Barsavi remained bullish, but he wore his years in plain view. He was rounder and softer now, his 3 braided grey beards backed by 3 wobbly chins. Dark circles cupped his eyes, and his cheeks were the unhealthy sort of red that came out of a bottle. Flushed with exertion, he had thrown off his overcoat and was working in his silk undertunic. Standing nearby with folded arms were Andres and Pachero Barsavi, Nazca's older brothers. Andres was like a miniature version of the Kappa, minus 30 years and 2 beards, while Panchero was more of a kind with Nazca, tall and slender and curly-haired. Both of the brothers wore optics, for whatever eye trouble the old Madame Barsavi had borne had been passed to all 3 of her surviving children. Leaning against the far wall were 2 women. They were not slender. Their bare, tanned arms were corded with muscle and crisscrossed with scars, and while they radiated an air of almost feral good health, they were well past the girlishness of early youth. Sherin and Raiza Barangias, identical twins, and the greatest contrarricala the city of Camor had ever known. Performing only as a pair, they had given the shifting revel almost 100 performances against sharks, devilfish, death lanterns, and other predators of the Iron Sea. For nearly 5 years they had been Kappa Barsavi's personal bodyguards and executioners. Their long, wild manes of smoke-black hair were tied back under nets of silver that jangled with shark's teeth. One tooth, it was said, for every man or woman the Barangius twins had killed in Barsavi's service. Last, but certainly not least alarming in this exclusive gathering, was Sage Kindness, a round-headed man of moderate height and middle years. His short-cropped hair was the butter yellow of certain Therin families from the westerly cities of Carthane and Lashane. His eyes always seemed to be wet with emotion, though his expression never changed. He was perhaps the most even-tempered man in Camor. He could pull fingernails with the mellow disinterest of a man polishing boots. Kappa Barsavi was a very capable torturer, but when he found himself stymied, the sage never disappointed him.
"He doesn't know anything!"
The last prisoner, as yet untouched, hollered at the top of his voice as Barsavi slapped Federica around some more.
"Kappa, Your Honor, please! None of us know anything! Gods, none of us remember!"
Barsavi stalked across the wooden floor and shut the second prisoner up by giving his windpipe a long, cruel squeeze.
"Were the questions addressed to you? Are you eager to get involved in the proceedings? You were quiet enough when I sent your other 6 friends down into the water. Why do you cry for this one?"
"Please,"
the man sobbed, sucking in air as Barsavi lightened his grip just enough to permit speech.
"Please, there's no point. You must believe us, Kappa Barsavi, please. We'd have told you anything you wanted if only we knew. We don't remember. We just don't..."
The Kappa silenced him with a vicious cuff across the face. For a moment, the only sound in the room was the frightened sobbing and gasping of the 2 prisoners.
"I must believe you? I must do nothing, Julien. You give me bullshit and tell me it's steamed beef? So many of you, and you can't even come up with a decent story. A serious attempt to lie would still piss me off, but I could understand it. Instead, you cry that you don't remember. You, the 8 most powerful men in the Full Crowns, after Tessa himself. His chosen, his friends, his bodyguards, his loyal peasant. And you cry like babies to me about how you don't remember where any of you were last night when Tessa just happened to die."
"But that's just how it is, Kappa Barsavi. Please, it's..."
"I ask you again. Were you drinking last night?"
"No, not at all."
"Were you smoking anything? All of you, together?"
"No, nothing like that. Certainly not together."
"Gaze, then? A little something from Jerem's pervert alchemists? A little bliss from a powder?"
"Tesso never permitted..."
"Well, then."
Barsavi drove a fist into Julien's solar plexus, almost casually. While the man gasped in pain, Barsavi turned away and held up his arms with theatrical joviality.
"Since we've eliminated every possible earthly explanation for such dereliction of duty, short of sorcery or divine intervention..." "Oh, forgive me. You weren't enchanted by the gods themselves, were you? They're hard to miss."
Julien writhed against his bonds, red-faced, shaking his head.
"Please!"
"No gods, then. Didn't think so. I was saying that your little game is boring the hell out of me. Kindness?"
The round-headed man lowered his chin to his chest and stood with his palms out, facing upward, as though he were about to receive a gift.
"I want something creative. If Federico won't talk, let's give Julien one chance to find his tongue."
Federico began screaming before Barsavi had even finished speaking, the high, sobbing wail of the conscious damned. Locke found himself clenching his teeth to keep himself from shaking. so many meetings with slaughter as a backdrop, the gods could be perverse. Sage Kindness moved to a small table to the side of the room, on which there was a pile of small glasses and a heavy cloth sack with a drawstring. Kindness threw several glasses into the sack and began banging it against the table. The sound of breaking, jangling glass wasn't audible beneath Federico's wild hollering, but Locke could imagine it easily enough. After a few moments, Kindness seemed satisfied and walked slowly over to Federico.
Don't, please, no.
With one hand holding the desperate young man's head still, Kindness rapidly drew the bag up over the top of his head, over his face, all the way to Federico's neck, where he cinched the drawstring tight. The bag muffled Federico's screams, which had become high and wordless again. Kindness then began to knead the bag, gently at first, almost tenderly. The torturer's long fingers pushed the jagged contents of the sack up and around Federico's face. Red stains began to appear on the surface of the bag. Kindness manipulated the contents of the sack like a sculptor giving form to his clay. Federico's throat mercifully gave out just then, and for the next few moments the man choked out nothing more than a few hoarse moans. Locke prayed silently that he'd already fled beyond pain to the temporary refuge of madness. Kindness increased the vigor with which he massaged the cloth. He pressed now where Federico's eyes would be, and on the nose and the mouth and the chin. The bag grew wetter and redder until at last Federico's twitching stopped altogether. When Kindness took his hands off the bag, they looked as though he'd been pulping tomatoes. Smiling sadly, he let his red hands drip red trails on the wood, and he walked over to Julian, staring intently, saying nothing.
"Surely," said Kappa Barsavi, "if I've convinced you of anything by this point, it must be the depth of my resolve. Will you not speak?"
"Please, Kappa Barsavi," whispered Julian. "There's no need for this. I have nothing I can tell you. Ask me anything, anything at all. What happened last night is a blank. I don't remember. I would tell you, please, gods, please believe me. I would tell you anything. We are loyal, Pezon, the most loyal you have."
"I sincerely hope not."
Barsavi seemed to come to a decision. He gestured to the Barangius sisters and pointed at Julian. The dark-haired ladies worked quickly and silently, undoing the knots that held him to the wooden frame while leaving the ones that bound him from ankles to neck. They cradled the shivering man effortlessly, one at his shoulders and one at his feet.
"Loyal? Please. We are grown men, Julian. Refusing to tell me the truth of what happened last night is not a loyal act. You've let me down, so I give like for like."
On the far left side of the great hall, a man-sized wooden floor panel had been slid aside. Barely a yard down was the dark surface of the water beneath the grave. The floor around the opening was wet with blood.
"I shall let you down."
Julian screamed one last time as the Barangius sisters heaved him into the opening, head first. He hit the water with a splash and didn't come back up. It was the Kappa's habit to keep something nasty down beneath the grave at all times, constrained there by heavy nets of wire-reinforced rope that surrounded the underside of the galleon like a sieve.
"Kindness, you are dismissed. Boys, when I call you back, you can get some people in here to clean up, but for now go wait on deck. Raiza, Sherin, please go with them."
Moving slowly, Kappa Barsavi walked to his plain, comfortable old chair and settled into it. He was breathing heavily and quivering all the more for his effort not to show it. A brass wine goblet with the capacity of a large soup tureen was set out on the little table beside his chair. The Kappa took a deep draught and seemed to brood over the fumes for a few moments his eyes closed. At last he came back to life and beckoned for Locke and Nazca to step forward.
"Well, my dear Master Lamora, how much money have you brought me this week?"
7. 36 solons, 5 coppers, Your Honor.
A slender week's work, it seems.
Yes, with all apologies, Copper Barsavi. The rain, well, sometimes it's murder on those of us doing second-story work. Barsavi set the goblet down and folded his right hand inside his left, caressing the reddened knuckles.
You've brought me more, of course, many times, better weeks.
Yes.
There are some that don't, you know. They try to bring me the exact same amount week after week after week, until I finally lose patience and correct them. Do you know what that sort of garista must have, Locke?
A very boring life?
Ha! Yes, exactly. How very stable of them to have the exact same income every single week, so they might give me the exact same percentage as a cut, as though I were an infant who would not notice. And then there are garistas such as yourself. I know you bring me the honest percentage, because you're not afraid to walk in here and apologize for having less than last week.
I do hope I'm not considered shy about sharing when the balance tilts the other way.
Not at all.
Barsavi smiled and settled back in his chair. Ominous splashing and muffling banging was coming from beneath the floor in the vicinity of the hatch that Julian had vanished down.
You are, if anything, the most reliably correct garista in my service, like Ferrari clockwork. You deliver my cut yourself, promptly and without a summons, for 4 years, week in and week out, unfailing since Chains died. Never once did you suggest that anything took precedence over your personal appearance before me, with that bag in your hand.
Kappa Barsavi pointed at the small leather bag Locke held in his left hand, and gestured to Nazca. Her formal role in the Barsavi organization was to act as finicker, or record keeper. She could rattle off the running total of the payments made by any gang in the city, itemized week by week and year by year without error. Locke knew she updated records on parchment for her father's private use, but so far as the Kappa's subjects in general knew, every coin of his fabled treasure was catalogued solely behind her cold and lovely eyes. Locke tossed the leather purse to her, and she plucked it out of the air.
"Never," said Kappa Barsavi. "Did you think to send a peasant to do a garista's job?"
"Well, you're most kind, Your Honor. But you made that very easy today, since only garistas are allowed past the door."
"Don't dissemble. You know of what I speak. Nazca, love, Locke and I must now be alone."
Nazca gave her father a deep nod, then gave a much quicker, shallower one to Locke. She turned and walked back toward the doors to the entrance hall, iron heels echoing on the wood.
"I have many garistas," Barsavi said when she was gone, "tougher than yourself. Many more popular, many more charming, many with larger and more profitable gangs, but I have very few who are constantly at pains to be so courteous, so careful."
Locke said nothing.
"My young man, while I take offense at many things, rest assured that courtesy is not one of them. Come, stand easy. I'm not fitting you for a noose."
"Sorry, Kappa. It's just, you've been known to begin expressing your displeasure in a very,
roundabout fashion?"
"Chains told me enough about scholars of the Therin Collegium," said Locke, "to understand that their primary habit of speech is the, booby trap."
"Ha! Yes. When anyone tells you habits die hard, Locke, they're lying. It seems they never die at all.
Barsavi chuckled and sipped from his wine before continuing. These are alarming times, Locke. This damn Grey King has finally begun to get under my skin. The loss of Tesso is particularly... Well, I had plans for him. Now I am forced to begin bringing other plans forward sooner than intended. Tell me, Pezon, what do you think of Andres and Pacero? Well, my honest opinion, Your Honor? Full and honest, Pezon, by my command. Ah, they're very respected, very good at their jobs. Nobody jokes about them behind their backs. Jean says they really know how to handle themselves in a fight. The Sansas are nervous about playing fair card games with them, which is saying something. This I could hear from 24 spies any time I wanted to. This I know. What is your personal opinion of my sons? Locke swallowed and looked Kappa Barsavi straight in the eyes. Well, they are worthy of respect. They are good at their jobs, and they must know their business in a fight. They're fairly hard workers, and they're bright enough. But, Your Honor, begging your pardon, they tease Nazca when they should be heeding her warnings and taking her advice. She has the patience and the subtlety that elude them? You knew what I was going to say, didn't you? I said you were a careful and considerate Garista, Locke. Those are your distinguishing characteristics, though they imply many other qualities. Since the time of your prodigious early cock-ups, you have been the very picture of a careful thief, firmly in control of his own greed. You would be very sensitive to any opposing lack of caution in others. My sons have lived all their lives in a city that fears them because of their last name. They expect deference in an aristocratic fashion. They are incautious, a bit brazen. I need to make arrangements to ensure that they receive good counsel in the months and years to come. I can't live forever, even after I deal with the Grey King. The jovial certainty that filled Kappa Barsavi's voice when he said this made the hair on the back of Locke's neck stand up. The Kappa was sitting in a fortress he hadn't left in more than 2 months, drinking wine in air still rank with the blood of 8 members of one of his most powerful and loyal gangs. Was Locke speaking to a man with a far-ranging and subtle scheme? Or had Barsavi finally cracked, like window glass in a fire? "I should very much like," said the Kappa, "to have you in a position to give Andres and Pacero the counsel they'll require." "Ah, Your Honor, that's extremely flattering, but I get along well enough with Andres and Pacero, but I'm not exactly what you'd call a close friend. We play some cards every now and then, but let's be honest, I'm not a very important Garista." "As I said, even with the Grey King at work in my city, I have many who are tougher than you, more daring than you, more popular. I don't say this to strike a blow, because I've already discussed your own qualities. And it is those qualities they sorely need. Not toughness, daring, or charm, but cold and steady caution. Prudence. You are my most prudent, Garista. You only think of yourself as the least important because you make the least noise. Tell me now, what do you think of Nazca?"
"Nazca?"
Locke was suddenly even warier than before. "She's brilliant, Your Honor. She can recite conversations we had 10 years ago and get every word right, especially if it embarrasses me. You think I'm prudent? Compared to her, I'm as reckless as a bear in an alchemist's lab." "Yes," said the Kappa. "Yes. She should be the next Kappa Barsavi when I'm gone, but that won't happen. It's nothing to do with her being a woman, you know. Her older brothers would simply never stand to have their little sister lording it over them. And I should prefer not to have my children murdering one another for scraps of the legacy I intend to leave them, so I cannot push them aside in her favor. What I can do, and what I must do,
is ensure that when the time comes, they will have a voice of sobriety in such a place that they cannot get rid of it. You and Nazca are old friends, yes? I remember the first time you met, so many years ago, when she used to sit on my knee and pretend to order my men around. In all the years since, you have always stopped to see her, always given her kind words, always been her good peasant. I certainly hope so, Your Honor. I know you have. Barsavi took a deep draught from his wine goblet, then set it back down firmly, a magnanimous smile on his round, wrinkled face. And so I give you my permission to court my daughter. Let's start wobbling, shall we? Said Locke's knees, but this offer was met by a counterproposal from his better judgment to simply freeze up and do nothing, like a man treading water who sees a tall black fin coming straight at him. Oh, he finally said, I didn't expect... Of course not, said Barsavi, but in this our purposes are complementary. I know you and Nazca have feelings for one another. A union between the two of you would bring you into the Barsavi family. You would become Andrzej Sanpachero's responsibility, and they yours. Don't you see? A brother by bonding would be much harder for them to ignore than even their most powerful garista. Barsavi set his left fist inside his right and smiled broadly once again, like a red-faced god dispensing benevolence from a celestial throne. Locke took a deep breath. There was nothing else for it. The situation required absolute acquiescence, as surely as if the Kappa were holding a crossbow to his temple. Men died for refusing Barsavi far less. To refuse the Kappa's own daughter would be a particularly messy sort of suicide. If Locke balked at the Kappa's plan, he wouldn't live out the night.
I'm honored, Kappa Barsavi, so deeply honored. I hope not to disappoint you.
Disappoint me? Certainly not. Now, I know that several of my other garistas have had their eyes on Nazca for some time, but if one of them were going to catch her eye, he'd have done it by now, eh? What a surprise when they hear the news. They'll never see this coming.
And for a wedding present, thought Locke, the angry jealousy of an unknown number of jilted suitors.
How and when should I begin, Your Honor? Well, said Barsavi, why don't I give you a few days to think it over? I'll speak to her in the interim. Of course, for the time being, she's not to leave the floating grave. Once the Grey King is dealt with... Well, I would expect you to begin courting her in a more colourful and public fashion.
You're telling me, Locke said very carefully, I should start stealing more, then.
Consider it my challenge to you to go hand in hand with my blessing. Barsavi smirked. Let's see if you can stay prudent while becoming more productive. I suspect you can. And I know that you wouldn't want to disappoint me or my daughter.
Certainly not, Your Honor. I'll do my very best.
Kappa Barsavi beckoned Locke forward and held his left hand out, fingers outstretched, palm down. Locke knelt before Barsavi's chair, took that hand with both of his own, and kissed the Kappa's ring, that familiar black pearl with the blood-red heart.
Kappa Barsavi,
he said with his eyes to the ground. The Kappa pulled him up again by the shoulders.
I give you my blessing, Locke Lamora. The blessing of an old man who worries for his children. I set you above many dangerous people by doing this for you. Surely it has occurred to you that my sons will inherit a dangerous office. And if they're not careful enough or hard enough for the task, well... Stranger things have happened. Some day this city could be ruled by Kappa Lamora. Have you ever dreamed of this?
Truthfully, whispered Locke, I have never desired a Kappa's power because I would never want a Kappa's problems.
Well, there's that prudence again. The Kappa smiled and gestured toward the far doors, giving Locke permission to withdraw. A Kappa's problems are very real, but you've helped me put one of them to rest.
Locke walked back toward the entrance hall, thoughts racing. The Kappa sat on his chair behind him, staring at nothing, saying no more. The only sounds after that were Locke's own footsteps and the steady drip of blood from the gore-soaked bag around Federico's head.
8. Well, Nazca, if I were 1,000 years old and had already seen everything there is to see 6 times over, that still would have been about the last damn thing I'd have ever expected.
She was waiting for him in the little hall beyond the foyer. Once the clockwork mechanisms had sealed the door to the main hall behind them, she gave him a wry and apologetic look.
But don't you see that it would have been even stranger if I'd explained it beforehand?
The whole mess would be hard-pressed to get any god's damned weirder.
Look, please, don't take any of this the wrong way. I don't take any of it the wrong way, Locke. You're a good friend, and I feel the same way, and yet it's hard to put this right. No, it isn't. Look.
She grabbed him by the shoulders and bent down slightly to look right into his eyes.
You are a good friend, Locke. Probably the best I have. My loyal Pezon. I'm extremely fond of you, but not as a possible husband. And I know that you... Locke, said Nazca, I know that the only woman with the key to that peculiar heart of yours is 1,000 miles away, and I know you'd rather be miserable over her than happy with anyone else.
Really? Locke balled his fists. Seems like it's pretty common fucking knowledge. I bet the Duke gets regular reports. Seems as though your father is the only person who doesn't know.
Or doesn't care. Nazca raised her eyebrows. Locke, it's Kappa de Pezon. It's not personal. He gives the orders and you carry them out, in most cases.
But not this one? I thought you'd be happy. At least he's making plans for the future again.
I said reasonable plans.
Nazca smiled, a real smile this time.
Come on, Pezon. Play along for a few days. We can go through the motions and put our heads together to come up with a way out of this. It's you and me we're talking about, right? The old man can't win, and he won't even know he's lost.
Right, if you say so.
Yes, I say so. Come back the day after tomorrow. We'll scheme. We'll slip this noose. Now go tend to your boys, and be careful.
Locke stepped back out into the entrance hall, and Nazca pushed the doors shut behind him. He stared back at her as the space between the black doors narrowed, gradually sealing her off from view until they slammed shut with the click of tumbling locks. He could have sworn she winked just before the heavy black doors closed between them.
"And this is the card you picked, the 6 of Spires," said Carlo, holding up a card and displaying it for the entrance hall guards.
"Fuck me," said one of them. "That's sorcery!"
"Nah, it's just the old sun's a touch."
Carlo reshuffled his deck one-handed and held it out toward Locke.
"Care to give it a go, boss?"
"No thanks, Carlo."
"Pack up, lads. Our business here is finished for the day, so let's quit bothering the folks with the crossbows."
He punctuated this with hand gestures. "Major complications. Discuss elsewhere."
"Damn, I'm hungry," said Jean, picking up the cue. "Why don't we get something at the last mistake and take it up to our rooms?"
"Yeah," said Bug. "Beer and apricot tarts."
"A combination so disgusting I feel oddly compelled to actually try it."
Jean swatted the smallest gentleman bastard on the back of his head, then led the way as the gang made for the slender wooden path that tied the floating grave to the rest of the world.
9. Save Kappa Barsavi,
who imagined that Locke's gang merely continued sitting the steps a few days of the week, even with chains in his grave, no right people of Camor knew that the gentleman bastard still worked out of the house of Perelandro. Carlo and Galdo and Bug let rooms at various points in and around the snare, moving every few months. Locke and Jean had maintained the fiction of rooming together for several years. By a great stroke of luck, though whether it was good or ill had yet to be determined, really, Jean had managed to get them the rooms on the 7th floor of the broken tower. The night was dark and full of rain, and none of the gang were particularly eager to make their way back onto the creaking exterior stairs that staggered down the north side of the tower. Hissing rain rattled the window shutters, and the wind made an eerie rising and falling sigh as it passed over the gaps and crevices in the old tower. The gentleman bastard sat on floor cushions in the light of paper lanterns and nursed the last of their beer, the pale, sweet sort that most Camor natives preferred to the bitter Varari dark. The air was stuffy, but at least tolerably dry. Locke had given them the whole story over dinner.
"Well," said Galdo, "this is the damnedest damned thing that ever damned things up for us."
"I say again," said Jean, "that we should pull an early blow-off on the Don Salvara game and get ready to ride out a storm. This Grey King business is getting scary, and we can't have our attention diverted if Locke's going to be mixed up at the middle of things."
"Where do we cut ourselves off?" asked Carlo.
"We cut ourselves off now," said Jean. "Now, or after we get one more note out of the Don. No later."
Locke stared down at the dregs in the bottom of his tin cup. "We've worked hard for this one. I'm confident we can run it for another 5 or 10,000 crowns, at least. Maybe not the 25,000 we were hoping to squeeze out of Salvara, but enough to make ourselves proud. I got the crap kicked out of me, and Bug jumped off a building for this money, you know."
"And got rolled 2 miles inside a bloody barrel!"
"Now, Bug," said Galdo, "it's not as though the nasty old barrel jumped you in an alley and forced you to crawl inside it. And I concur with Jean. I said it this afternoon, Locke. Even if you won't seriously consider using them, can we at least make some arrangements to get you under cover in a hurry? Maybe even out of town?"
"I still can't believe I'm hearing a Sansa counsel caution," Locke said with a grin. "I thought we were richer and cleverer than everyone else."
"You'll hear it again and again when there's a chance you'll get your throat slit, Locke." Carlo picked up his brother's argument. "I've changed my mind about the Grey King, that's for damn sure. Maybe the lone lunatic does have it over the 3,000 of us. You might be one of his targets. And if Barsavi wants you even tighter with his inner circle, it invites further trouble."
"Can we set aside talk of slitting throats just for a moment?"
Locke rose and turned toward the shuttered seaward window. He pretended to stare out of it with his hands folded behind his back.
"Who are we, after all? I admit I was almost ready to jump into the God's damned bay when the Kappa sprang this on me. But I've had time to think. So get this straight. We've got the old fox dead to rights. We've got him in the palms of our hands. Honestly, boys, we're so good at what we do that he's asking the Thorn of fucking Camor to marry his daughter. We're so far in the clear, it's comical."
"Nonetheless," said Jean, "it's a complication that could mess up our arrangements forever, not an accomplishment we can crow about."
"Of course we can crow about it, Jean. I'm going to crow about it right now. Don't you see? This is nothing we don't do every day. It's a plain old gentleman bastard sort of job, only we'll have Nazca working with me to pull it off as well. We can't lose. I'm no more likely to marry her than I am to be named Duke Nicovanti's heir tomorrow morning."
"Do you have a plan?" Jean's eyes said he was curious but wary.
"Not even remotely. I don't have the first damn clue what we're going to do. But all my best plans start just like this."
Locke tipped the last of his beer down his throat and tossed the tin cup against the wall.
"I've had my beer and I've had my apricot tarts, and I say the hell with them both.
Grey King and Kappa Barsavi. Nobody's going to scare us out of our Don Salvara game, and nobody's going to hitch me and Nazca against our will. We'll do what we always do. Wait for an opening, take it, and fucking well win.
Well, Jean sighed. Will you at least let us take a few precautions? And will you watch yourself coming and going?
Naturally, Jean, naturally. You grab us some places on likely ships. Spend whatever you have to. I don't care where they're going as long as it's not Jerem. We can lose ourselves anywhere for a few weeks and creep back when we please. Carlo, Galdo, you get out to the Viscount's gate tomorrow. Leave some considerations for the boys in yellow so we can get out of the city at an awkward hour if we need to. Don't be shy with the silver and gold.
What can I do? Asked Bug.
You can watch our backs. Keep your eyes wide open. Skulk around the temple. Spot me anyone out of place, anyone who lingers too long. If anyone is trying to keep an eye on us, I guarantee we will go to ground and vanish like piss into the ocean. Until then, trust me. I promise to do most of my moving around as Lucas Fairwhite for the next few days. I can swap in some cheaper disguises, too.
Then I suppose that's that, Jean said quietly.
Jean, I can be your garista, or I can just be the fellow who buys beer and tarts when everyone else mysteriously misplaces their purses. Locke eyed the gathering with an exaggerated scowl. I can't be both. It's one or the other.
I'm nervous, said Jean, because I don't like having as little information as I fear we do. I share Nazca's suspicions. The Grey King has something up his sleeves, something we don't understand. Our game is very delicate and our situation is very fluid.
I know, but I follow my gut, and my gut says that we meet this one head on with smiles on our faces. Look, said Locke, the more we do this, the more I learn about what I think Chains was really training us for. And this is it. He wasn't training us for a calm and orderly world where we could pick and choose when we needed to be clever. He was training us for a situation that was fucked up on all sides. Well, we're in it, and I say we're equal to it. I don't need to be reminded that we're up to our heads in dark water. I just want you boys to remember that we're the gods' damned sharks.
Right on, cried Bug. I knew there was a reason I let you lead this gang.
Well, I can't argue with the manifest wisdom of the boy that jumps off temple roofs, but I trust my points are noted, said Jean.
Very noted, said Locke. Received, recognized, and duly considered with the utmost gravity. Sealed, notarized, and firmly imprinted upon my rational essence.
Gods, you really are cheerful about this, aren't you? You only play vocabulary games when you feel genuinely sunny about the world.
Jean sighed, but couldn't keep the slightest hint of a smile from tugging at the corners of his lips.
If you do end up in danger, Locke, said Carlo, you must understand that we will ignore the orders of our garista and will bludgeon our friend on the back of his thick skull and smuggle him out of Camor in a box. I have just the bludgeon for the job.
And I have a box, said Galdo. Been hoping for an excuse to use it for years, really.
Also noted, said Locke, with thanks. But by the grace of the crooked warden, I choose to trust us. I choose to trust Chain's judgment. I choose to keep doing what we do best. Tomorrow I've got some work to do as Fairwhite, and then I'll go see Nazca again the day after. The Kappa will be expecting it, and I'm sure she'll have some ideas of her own by then.
Locke thought once again of his last glimpse of her, that wink as the two great doors of dark wood slammed shut between them. Maintaining her father's secrets was Nazca's entire life. Did it mean something for her to have one of her own that she could keep from him? Interlude. The Boy Who Cried for a Corpse. 1. Father Chains gave Locke no respite from his education on the day after the visit to the last mistake. With his head still pounding from a brown sugar rum headache,
Locke began to learn about the priesthood of Perelandro and the priesthood of the Benefactor. There were hand signs and ritual intonations, methods of greeting and meanings behind robe decorations. On his fourth day in Chain's care, Locke began to sit the steps as one of the initiates of Perelandro, clad in white and trying to look suitably humble and pathetic. As the weeks passed, the breadth of Chain's instruction expanded. Locke did 2 hours of reading and scribing each day. His pen scratchings grew smoother step by halting step, until the Sansa brothers announced that he no longer wrote, "Like a dog with an arrow in its brain." Locke was moved enough by their praise to dust their sleeping pallets with red pepper. The Sansas were distraught when their attempted retaliation was foiled by the utter paranoia Locke still carried with him from his experiences in Shade's Hill and the Catchfire Plague. It was simply impossible to sneak up on him or catch him sleeping. "The brothers have never before met their match in mischief," said Chains, as he and Locke sat the steps one particularly slow day. "Now they're wary of you. When they start coming to you for advice, well, that's when you'll know that you have them tamed." Locke had smiled and said nothing. Just that morning, Carlo had offered to give Locke extra help with his sums, if the smallest gentleman bastard would only tell the twins how he kept spotting their little booby traps and rendering them harmless. Locke revealed precious few of his survival tricks, but he did accept the help of both Sansas in his study of arithmetic. His only reward for each accomplishment was a more complex problem from Chains. At the same time, he began his education in spoken Vardran. Chains would issue simple commands in the language, and once Locke was reasonably familiar with the tongue, Chains often forbade the three boys to speak anything else for hours at a time. Even their dinner conversation was conducted in the harsh and illogical language of the North. To Locke, it often seemed impossible to say anything in Vardran that didn't sound angry. "You won't hear this among the right people much, but you'll hear it on the docks and among the merchants. That's for damn sure," said Chains. "And when you hear someone speaking it, don't ever let on that you know it, unless you absolutely have to. You'd be surprised how arrogant some of those northern types are when it comes to their speech. Just play dumb, and you never know what they might let slip." There was more instruction in the culinary arts. Chains had Locke slaving away at the cooking hearth every other night, with Carlo and Galdo vigorously henpecking him in tandem. "This is Vice Aloapona, the fifth beautiful art of Camor," said Chains. "Guild chefs learn all 8 styles better than they learn the uses of their own cocks, but you'll just get the basics for now. Mind you, our basics piss on everyone else's best. Only Carthane and Emberlane come close. Most Vardrans wouldn't know fine cuisine from rat shit in lamp oil. Now, this is pinch of gold pepper, and this is Jereshti olive oil, and just behind them I keep dried cinnamon lemon rind." Locke stewed octopus and boiled potatoes. He sliced pears and apples and alchemical hybrid fruit that oozed honey-scented liquor. He spiced and seasoned and bit his tongue in furious concentration. He was frequently the architect of gruesome messes that were hauled out behind the temple and fed to the goat. But as he improved at everything else required of him, he improved steadily at the hearth. Soon the Sansas ceased to tease him and began to trust him as an assistant with their own delicate creations. One night, about 1/2 year after his arrival at the House of Perelandro, Locke and the Sansas collaborated on a stuffed platter of infant sharks. This was Vice Entemere, the first beautiful art, the cuisine of sea creatures. Carlo gutted the soft-skinned little sharks and stuffed them with red and yellow peppers, which had in turn been stuffed with sausage and blood cheese by Locke. The tiny staring eyes of the creatures were replaced with black olives. Once the little teeth were plucked out, their mouths were stuffed with glazed carrots and rice, and their fins and tails were cut off to be boiled in soup.
"Ah," said Chains, when the elaborate meal was settling in four appreciative gullets. "Now that was genuinely excellent, boys. But while you're cleaning up and scouring the dishes, I only want to hear you speaking Vadran." And so it went. Locke was schooled further in the art of setting a table and waiting on individuals of high station. He learned how to hold out a chair and how to pour tea and wine. He and the Sansas conducted elaborate dinner-table rituals with the gravity of physicers cutting open a patient. There were lessons in clothing, the tying of cravats, the buckling of shoes, the wearing of expensive affectations such as hose. In fact, there was a dizzying variety of instruction in virtually every sphere of human accomplishment except thievery. As the first anniversary of Locke's arrival at the temple loomed, that changed. "I owe some favors, boys," said Chains one night as they all hunkered down in the lifeless rooftop garden. This was where he preferred to discuss all the weightier matters of their life together, at least when it wasn't raining. "Favors I can't put off when certain people come calling."
"Like the Kappa?" asked Locke.
"Not this time." Chains took a long drag on his habitual after-dinner smoke. "This time I owe the Black Alchemists. You know about them, right?"
Carlo and Galdo nodded, but hesitantly. Locke shook his head.
"Well," said Chains, "there's a right and proper guild of alchemists, but they're very choosy about the sort of person they let in, and the sort of work they let them do. Black alchemists are sort of the reason the guild has such strict rules. They do business in false shop fronts with people like us. Drugs, poisons, what have you. The Kappa owns them, same as he owns us, but nobody really leans on them directly. They're, not the sort of people you want to upset. Jesseline Dorbar is probably the best of the lot. I had occasion to get poisoned once. She took care of it for me, so I owe her, and she's finally called in the favor. What she wants is a corpse."
"Beggar's barrow," said Carlo. "And a shovel," said Galdo.
"No, she needs a fresh corpse, still warm and juicy, as it were. See, the guilds of alchemists and physicers are entitled to a certain number of fresh corpses each year by ducal charter. Straight off the gallows for cutting open and poking around. The black alchemists don't receive any such courtesy, and Jesseline has some theories she wants to put to the test. So I've decided you boys are going to work together on your first real job. I want you to find a corpse, fresher than morning bread. Get your hands on it without attracting undue attention, and bring it here so I can hand it off to Jesseline."
"Steal a corpse? This won't be any fun," said Galdo.
"Think of it as a valuable test of your skills," said Chains.
"Are we likely to steal many corpses in the future?" asked Carlo.
"It's not a test of your corpse-plucking abilities, you cheeky little nitwit," Chains said amiably. "I mean to see how you all work together on something more serious than our dinner. I'll consider setting you up with anything you ask for, but I'm not giving you hints. You get to figure this one out on your own."
"Anything we ask for?" said Locke.
"Within reason," said Chains. "And let me emphasize that you can't make the corpse yourself. You have to find it honestly dead by someone else's doing."
So forceful was Chains' voice when he said this that the Sansa brothers stared warily at Locke for a few seconds, then gave each other a look with eyebrows arched.
"When," said Locke, "does this lady want it by?"
"She'd be very pleased to have it in the next week or so."
Locke nodded.